Welcome back to Administrative Static. Mark Chenoweth, John Vecchione, and Janine Yunus with you. And we are joined by our colleague, our senior litigation counsel here at NCLA, Russ Ryan, to talk about a win in the Fifth Circuit, which we keep saying that around here. But this one's an amicus win, Russ, but you led the effort on this case. Tell us about National Association of Private Fund Managers v. SEC. We keep beating the SEC, too. Slow learners over there, I guess.
Yeah, it's kind of amazing. This is at least the second time in the past year that the Fifth Circuit has wiped away one of the SEC's ambitious rulemakings. This one involved private fund managers. And the case was basically about lack of statutory authority, a very good decision.
And what are private fund managers, just to make sure everybody understands what these are? This isn't your Schwab or your Fidelity.
No. These are advisors to what are called private funds.
Like a hedge fund?
Hedge funds, private equity funds, the ones that are really available for the most part to the super rich and super sophisticated, as opposed to the types of mutual funds that you and I would ordinarily invest in that are open to the public and are regulated very heavily under the Investment Company Act.
So you can't jump into one of these private funds unless you're invited?
Pretty much.
Okay.
Yeah. You have to know how
to get, know somebody. Yeah,
I'm just guesstimating. No one's ever invited me.
I was in Greenwich where all the hedge fund guys and all the guys live. That's how you do it.
Yeah. If you don't know where the secret door is, you can't get
exactly
in.
Exactly.
Right. But just basically, if you think about it, these are the people, these investors are the least likely to need suffocating regulation to protect them.
Both because they can absorb the losses and because they're sophisticated investors?
Yeah, and because these private funds are, they compete for these people's money. They really want these people as their, investors. And so it's a pretty efficient market out there.
Amazing how the market can solve some of these problems that the government wants to just regulate. But so what was the government trying to do here? What was the rule purporting to?
So the SEC decided that, we do want to subject these private fund managers to this pretty much the same regulation that other investment advisors are subject to. Some of the litigants contended that the rule would subject them, ironically, to more onerous regulation than, for example, somebody overseeing a Schwab mutual fund or something like that. I don't know enough about it to gauge whether that's true or not. But in any event, for all practical purposes, what had long been an exemption for private funds and private fund managers from onerous regulation would have been severely reduced so that these private fund managers would all of a sudden have a lot more record keeping and other kinds of, and there were also prohibitions on some common features of these funds. Like there's a lot of private negotiation that goes on between the fund manager and particular investors. And
these are not cookie cutter contracts.
No. And like I said, there's a lot of, there's a robust market to try to get these people to invest. And so there's oftentimes contractual provisions that the SEC just doesn't like. And you wouldn't want them if it were just a mom and pop investor. But these people can fend for themselves and they trade off.
They may give up one thing that matters
exactly,
less to them in exchange
exactly,
for something
exactly.
else that matters more to
but
them.
But the SEC decided let's jump into this with the 600-page rule or something like that.
Put a Procrustean bed of regulations down on these.
So this was back in, I guess they finalized the rule in August 2023. A bunch of trade association, private fund management groups immediately challenged it, I think, in September.
And this was Gene Scalia at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher?
He was leading the Gibson, Dunn team. So we submitted a supporting amicus brief in November 2023, and we basically argued in part what the court ultimately found, which was the statutory provisions that the SEC was claiming empowered it to adopt this rule simply didn't. And there were two basic statutory provisions they relied on. One was this provision in Dodd-Frank. Now, Dodd-Frank itself was kind of a behemoth.
2010 law that regulated a whole lot of like the market.
16 titles to it. It was almost 900 pages long. Title 4 of Dodd-Frank was specifically addressed to modest new regulations for hedge fund managers and other private fund managers. I think private fund managers or private funds was in the title.
Okay. The name disclosure of the title. Requirements or something.
Right. They had, well, it did subject them to registration requirements and some limited record keeping and other things. But that was the only section of Dodd-Frank that had anything to do with private funds or private fund managers. And the SEC itself even didn't claim that that title of
Dodd-Frank. Right. For 13 years, no one thought this gave any power.
Or even today, they don't claim it. What they did was they skipped forward 250 pages further into Dodd-Frank at a provision that obviously related solely to the relationship between advisors and retail clients. And they found this little mouse hole in that section where the word retail did not qualify the word investor. And they said, aha, Congress must have empowered us there to take, you know, to increase regulation of private fund managers. You would think, had any authority in Dodd-Frank been legitimate, it would have been Title IV.
Well, you'd think that if they take 900 pages to write it, they would have been explicit about any power that they were giving,
you
right?
You think so. I mean, you could say a lot in 900 pages.
Even lawyers.
So the second provision they relied on was a legacy provision in the Investment Advisors Act, Section 2064.
A 1940 law.
Yeah, and that's a bit one of these general anti-fraud provisions, and then it also says, oh yeah, and the SEC is empowered to adopt rules reasonably designed to prevent fraud, basically. And the SEC said that also empowers us to do this because everything we're requiring in this rule could theoretically prevent fraud. And the court just said, look, that's just pretextual.
Well, this law is, you know, 83 years old at the time that the rule came out, and no one had thought that it empowered them to do this before that. So
yeah, so
it seems like they're rummaging about in old statutes a lot. Why not just go to Congress and ask for this authority?
I've been thinking that since the decision came out. I mean, imagine the frustration of the staff of the SEC. How much time and effort it takes to write a 600-page rule, only to have it completely swept aside. You know, it occurs to me, like, wouldn't that time be better spent lobbying Congress to give it authority to do what it wants to do, or to write a statute?
Dodd-Frank is not that old. In the securities area, you can get things through when you show there's a reason, because it's not as partisan an idea.
Yeah, the SEC has been, in my observation over my career, pretty successful. When it wants Congress to do something, especially if it's got the right makeup.
Yeah, and a crisis that it doesn't want to let go to waste.
Yeah, I mean, they've gotten all kinds of gifts from Congress over the years, and it's basically ask and ye shall receive. That's been my perception. And it doesn't make any sense to me why they spend years and thousands of staff hours coming up with these regulations. They must know that they're going to get challenged, and they don't really have the statutory authority. They're just making it up.
And this seems like a case. I mean, this is a $26 trillion private fund industry. It seems like this is the kind of case where the court could have relied on something like the major questions doctrine to say, you know, we're not going to read the mouse hole this way. But it seems like it was more of a just straight up statutory interpretation.
Major questions did not come up. Non-delegation did not come up. The court did note that the SEC's own estimate of how much this would cost the industry, I think it was $5 billion. So it's, you know, it's real money. But I don't think anyone, I don't remember from the parties' briefs whether they they raised major questions, but the court apparently didn't think it was necessary to go there. I mean, it was pretty straight on. Oh, there was a standing issue, too. I should mention that because it was a helpful standing decision, too, all about associational standing. And the SEC claimed that these private fund manager organizations did not have standing because they neglected to identify by name particular member or members who would be harmed by the rule. And in effect, the Fifth Circuit said, no. If it's an associational standing and every member of the association is necessarily affected by the regulation, as in this case, you don't have to call out by name any particular member. You're good. I mean,
do you want to mention Paul Mahoney, Adam Pritchard, oh, yeah. J.W. Verrett, our securities law scholars who signed on to this?
Yeah, yeah. They were our co-amici. We were an amicus, an amicus. You pronounce it, John, right? An amicus ourselves, but our co-amici were Professor Paul Mahoney at UVA Law, Professor Adam Pritchard at the University of Michigan Law.
Very old friend of mine.
J.W. Verrett at the Scalia Law School at George Mason University. So very thankful for them. In fact, it was them that inspired us.
Right. It was based in part on, I think, comments that they had made to the rule. So great for them to join with us. And we commend the Fifth Circuit for reining in the SEC's latest rampant abuse. Thank you, Russ.
Thank you.